Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
October 29th, 2017. Episode number 119. Puttering Around. My name's Kevin England, and this is the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. Yeah, you just heard that, but now we have that out of the way. It's Sunday morning, and I'm vegging out while playing a little B.B. King, How Blue Can You Get, to have some background for today's activities. Nope, I'm not blue, even with a forecast of inches of rain today. In fact, I'm looking forward to the day of occupying oneself in a desultory but pleasant manner. That phrase is the definition of putter, by the way. I'm listening to Spotify, and specifically the Rolling Stones Get Your Ya-Ya's Out, which happens to have a little BB mixed in the song selections. I always feel like I should be moving, doing this or that, but when days with a forecast such as today come along, I plan to be a hermit in my little office and putter. And of course, one of my pleasures today will be to work on the podcast. To say that this past week has been an interesting one from a beekeeping standpoint is putting it mildly. It's not an earth-shattering, oh my, series of events, but when you hear beekeepers say that beekeeping always has surprises in store, well, this week serves to express that in spades. So today, I veg out, play on my computer, and well, I've reserved the start of my day with spending a little more time with my podcast friends, so let's go ahead and introduce the episode. Eyes on Hives, a gadget for tracking beehive activities. Homosote Winter Moisture Boards, a little more in-depth look. Broodminder, good to go with my broodminders, how about you? For Roundtable, bee-themed app names. Listener mail from Ben Stewart of BennyBeeHoney.com. Bandsaw Log Hive. Propolis Tincture follow-up. The Boys Are Back in Town, a podcast that's back on the air. And an introduction to MiteCalculator.com. And then at the end, a couple other little tidbits to share. But as we always do, let's go ahead and roll into the local hive report. Local hive report. What's to be said about the local hive report? A lot of things have happened in a time when a lot of things should not be happening. The weather here in New Jersey still remains relatively warm. In fact, it was 70-something degrees last night while we were at the racetrack at Bridgeport Speedway. And that's just silly at the end of October. But I should not be surprised, as the last couple of years it's remained warm through to November. And as it is, the yellow jackets continue to be a problem, and concerns about hive robbing continue to be a problem. Recently I closed all my hives down to one or two holes, and everything should be buttoned up. And I had planned last weekend to do oxalic vapor treatments if needed. I was going to monitor a couple of my hives, and if they needed, I was going to do a fall touch-up, but I ran out of time, so I did it this past weekend. So my game plan was, how can I do oxalic vapor treatments and put the vaporizer in the hive without messing up all of the hive entrances that I recently closed? And what I mean by that is, sometimes when you put a entrance reducer in, you really have to shove the thing in there. It squeezes underneath the box and it gets tight and you have to crack the boxes apart. And I taped everything up and I really didn't want to remove the entrances. And on some of my hives, I have that metal band that has the holes punched out of it. And it's there all the time and I didn't want to take them out. So how do you get an oxalic vaporizer into the bottom of the hive? So I've been pondering that solution all week long, and I had an idea. why not go from the top of the hive? One thing I don't know about oxalic vaporization is, does it require heat to make the plume rise? But from what I hear from everybody is that the fumes and the gas comes out of the hive and you have to wear a mask and you have to wear goggles and all of that. And in my estimation, if you do it from the bottom and it fills up the chamber, if you do it from the top and it gases off so much that it fills the entire chamber, then if it hits the top of the hive and has no place to go, it will bank down. That's my logic. So what I did was I took this device that I had, which is a double screen device, and it made it had a notch that was perfect that the oxalic vaporizer fits in it, and it solves a problem that I saw with the vaporizer. And again, I might be shooting myself in the foot, but let me explain. So the double screen board works this way. It's a shim. It has a screen tacked to it. Then it has a shim. And on top of that shim, a screen is tacked to it. And then another shim. So it's really a series of three shims with two screens. And in the top one, one of the shims is trimmed so it has an opening. I have no idea what the purpose of this device was. But what happens is you have a collar to set on a hive with a gap until there's a screen, and then a space and a second screen, and then a gap and something can be set on top. For me, this is the perfect situation. I could take my oxalic vaporizer, put it in the top gap and heat it up, and no bees will get to it from the bottom. And what I did was I took a inner cover and I put it on top of this thing and I taped it all the way down. And the inner cover had a hole in it so I could deliver the oxalic powder through the hole and tape that off and then light up the oxalic vaporizer and it would plume and push down through the screen into the hive and voila, oxalic vaporization. So the only thing that I don't know is if the vapors would go down, but I took my chances because I wasn't going to open the bottom of the hive. And the other thing was, I burn no bees. And I don't know if that's a huge consideration because I've got no practical experience on this. I was just being pragmatic about the ability not to have to open the hive. But if you take the oxalic vaporizer and you shove it in a bottom board while bees are coming and going and you turn it on, bees are going to get cooked in there. As it was, I did not cook any bees, but what I found was that when I first put the oxalic vaporizer on the hive and vaporized the hive, I had taped, but I didn't tape well enough and a lot of the fumes leaked out. Now, thankfully, I had a mask on, I had goggles on, I did my thing. Subsequently, I went around with blue painter's tape and taped it really, really tight and got it well organized. And from then on, after the first hive, everything went well. So I should say that I started off with a hive check. Did an alcohol wash on the cedar hive that sits on pad number one. And I didn't want to tell you. It looked like the other hive that I tested this year was just loaded with mites. And this hive had been treated with Apivar. I'm at a loss as to why. Actually, I'm not. Let me come clean. I had Apivar packages. I had one of them that was open. I used that package. And it specifically says on the Apivar package, don't use them if they're open. I didn't learn that till after I read the package and while I was sitting there. And the day that I was doing my Apivar treatments, what was I going to do? I could stop, drive to the store, buy some more, order more, or I could put them in the hive. So I put them in the hive. Now, which ones got those? I didn't take that good of notes. So maybe this hive didn't get a good Apivar treatment. But the one thing I know is when I opened these earlier, I did put them immediately into a Ziploc bag. But that's a rationalization. The product says that it is put into the package and vacuum sealed. And when you open it, you should use it right away. I could imagine if I took this thing and I put it in, say, a bucket and left it there, that it would eventually, all the chemical would come to the surface. I don't know the math as to why it does or doesn't work, but bottom line is, maybe that's the cause. So be it, right? I can't change that now. It is what it is. Last Sunday, I went hive by hive and just treated them all with oxalic. And one of the things I did was treat my Waray hive. And when I treated the Waray, I took the panels off so you could see the glass and see how the vaporization worked. Let's talk about that. In that box, which is three Waray boxes high, I saw the first box fill with fumes, a cloud, a vapor. The second box seemed to have a little bit, and you could see the bees kind of move around. They vacated the first box, which has some comb hanging in it, but not a ton of bees. Vacated it. On the second box, they moved around, but I didn't see a lot of impact. I have three glass panels. And when I vaporized this hive, I did not see any of the fog come up into that third top box. In fact, you would never know by the behavior of the bees that this thing was vaporized. That's interesting, isn't it? Here, I would have thought it would have just plumed the whole thing. And it was sealed. None of it leaked. Eventually, the crystals formed. What happens, from my understanding, is the cloud turns to crystals inside and coats everything inside the hive. And I could see evidence of that on the vaporizer and on the inside of the glass. It was there. Now I went and checked that hive subsequently and the bees cleaned it all off. So my guess is that's how it works. I don't know for sure. I didn't get to all of my hives. So this week I went through, actually yesterday, and did the remainder of my hives. And then this morning, since it's been 7 days, actually, let me say that differently. I did all the hives on that day, and you have to do three subsequent treatments, is my understanding, every 5 days. So I did all of the hives yesterday, but I didn't finish two of them, and this morning I did two, including the Waray hive again. And this time I brought a video camera and I recorded it. So I'm going to post that and you'll be able to see what happens there. While doing this, Jim Schmalz was helping me out and Bob Kloss happened to be in the neighborhood. He was coming back through from visiting a beekeeper south of us and he stopped in and we spent the day. And I recorded a couple things, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. But we watched a hive get robbed. And unfortunately, I know now that it has succumbed to being destroyed. It was the 8-frame hive. It is no more. So we're down to 12 hives in the yard. Lost the two last report and lost another one this week. And the interesting thing was that hive was taped down to one hole, literally, one hole opening, and still got taken over. The other thing that discovered is while I'm down to 12 hives, I actually have 13. So I was standing on a conference call. I worked from home one morning. I walked out to the one room, was looking out the window. We have a propane tank that feeds a stove. And I was standing there looking at the propane tank and I saw some bees flying by and I looked up and yeah, there's a hive in the soffit and I had no idea. So we have a hive living in the house. If it survives, we'll have to go in the spring and get it out of there. So 13 hives on the property. That's kind of funny. Sharon was actually amused. She wasn't mad. I thought for sure she would yell at me. It seems that we had a carpenter's nest, and they drilled a hole, and then the bees found the opportunity to use that hole in the soffit and fill the soffit. So I have no idea how far they are in there or how big they are. I might have to take the FLIR and see if I could figure that out. So from a local hive report, two treatments of oxalic on the hives. Next week I'm going to do one more and finish that up. And as to the rest of it, I'll save that for the next episode, which is going to come out sometime this week. Local hive report, check. Let's go ahead and roll into topic number one. Topic number one, I've got my eye on you. I'm working on a digital health project at work that helps patients with better managing their outcomes. And as they're being helped, so is the healthcare practitioner that they're working with. I'll refrain from going into details as they're not important here. Actually, what I want to talk about is the statement, managing your outcome. As a patient or simply a person, things happen in your life that have a direct impact on your outcome. The simplest example is if you don't brush your teeth, then it's highly likely that you will not have a good outcome, especially as it concerns your interactions with your dentist. Using this as an example, what if it was important, and in the case of medications that my company makes, it's life and death important, that you follow instructions, do whatever you're supposed to do, and report anything unusual? What if, using my analogy, the dentist could get a report that simply indicated that you brushed your teeth twice a day, flossed, you did it properly, and you did it well, meaning the right number of strokes or whatever properly means, and for the right amount of time, and you used a certain device better than a regular toothbrush, maybe you use an electronic toothbrush, and if they wanted you to rinse your mouth with ACT or some other scope, something like that, that they got a report every day. And as a healthcare practitioner or a dentist, when you're dealing with a patient, it's not the yes, they did it. It's the no, they didn't, or oh, they encountered a problem. Something has come up and I need to do something. So that's the interesting part about managing an outcome as it relates to a healthcare practitioner and a patient. And if you could give the patient something, a tool, that just takes care of this stuff and gives you a report card, but also indicates that something is wrong and you should do something differently or take action, that's where the world is going these days. You hear about Internet of Things. You hear about always online, cloud computing, analytics, all of this stuff. This is what all the companies are doing, mine included. And in the case of healthcare, that relationship between the healthcare practitioner and the patient is going to change. And we know this as people who are in the healthcare systems, most of us, by getting things like patient portals and other access to information that we never had before. Used to go to a doctor's office, you'd get your blood work, do whatever, they'd put it in a folder and it'd be sitting on a shelf in the doctor's office. Now I can log into my healthcare facility and see all my numbers and report the information. It's really amazing how much digital records are changing the way the world works. So how does this translate to beekeeping? Well, in the last couple years, you've seen the emergence of Internet of Things and sensors coming to hives. I've had great success lately with my broodminders. I'm watching them. I'm syncing all the time. I'm looking at my weights. You know, at first when I looked at them, I had to get used to them. I really wasn't looking at them other than a novelty. But I knew at time that I would eventually come to recognize patterns and be able to see how my hives are behaving. But what I had to do was establish a certain amount of insight, so to speak, on what was normal. And that's really important because what is normal and what should we learn about normal? It's actually interesting to watch the weights, the temperatures, and have observations about different things. And now what I'm going to talk about is Eyes on Hive, an Indiegogo solution that's out there that could be a complement to a broodminder solution where you have scales, you have humidity sensors, you have temperature sensors, and in some solutions you have sound sensors. So recently something came across on Eyes on Hive, which to me is a little bit of a boutique solution, but interesting nonetheless. If you've listened to the podcast over time, you know that we've deployed different technologies in different solutions I'm involved in, yes, I'm trying to be a little discreet here. Some of them are really costly and some of them are not. And I'm starting to wonder whether the really costly ones were really worth the costly amount. Because I know that sensors are what they are. I'm starting to lean towards they should be inexpensive and approachable and dial tone. I was at somebody's house the other day and they have this brand new refrigerator with like a 27-inch monitor built in. And the thing has sensors that tell you, you know, it's that crazy notion of why do you need your refrigerator or your washing machine to talk to you? But guess what, folks? It's coming. And this thing is amazing. The funny thing was, is it was a Samsung refrigerator, and I asked the homeowner if they had a Samsung phone to get the most value. No, they still have an iPhone. Wah, wah, wah. But if you have a Samsung phone and Samsung devices around your house, you will have the home of the future. And you could have smart lights and smart thermostats and smart door entry and all these other things along with your smart appliances. Anyway, I'm off on a tangent here. I'm really loving my Broodminder. Love them. I love the scales. I love the sensors. I make it a point to check in. I have a Cell, which is the new device that they have, which reports to the cloud automatically. And I'm watching my data. And so it makes me want to do more and more Internet of Things. And I saw this thing, Eyes on Hive, Honeybee Health Monitor. So what is it? Let me describe it to you. If I had to give a visual description, it looks like a radar gun. Something that you've seen, you know, that the state trooper standing along the road holding up a radar gun. It's very similar to that. But it has a flat panel on the back of it, and it looks like something that you would mount. And the premise of this thing is it simply watches bees coming and going at the front entrance. It's a camera, a $380 plus shipping camera, but its purpose is it maps all the bees, and the algorithms of the camera are looking at this, probably very similar to the technologies that Google and others are doing to recognize activity in a video or faces or things like that. Did you know these are out there? You know, we've talked about these, I think, in the past, a long time ago. They have different algorithms that will look at a photograph and be able to pick certain things out. And you could run these. You're probably familiar with them if you've ever used any of them. They're amazing. They could take a picture of me, and they could distinguish, even when I was a kid, that that's me out of a crowd. And it auto-catalogs your content. Now, it gets confused sometimes when it thinks about my twin brother, Keith. And other times, it sometimes picks out a relative that has similar features. But for the most part, these things are spot on. And this technology is only going to get better and better. Amazon has something called Rekognition. Rekognition. It's deep learning-based image recognition. It'll search, verify, and organize millions of images. And I'm sure Google and Microsoft and others have this same technology along with boutique algorithms that you could probably get at this point as open source because this stuff tends to trickle down to general folks. So using Amazon Rekognition as the example, with it, you can detect objects, scenes, faces, recognize celebrities, identify inappropriate content and images, search and compare faces, and so on. Now, they tend to have a more people focus, but they have other ones where you can find specific activities, and in this case, something like honeybees, and pick out a honeybee flying through. And if you can recognize it, you can tag it. And if you could tag it, you can count it. And if you can count it, you can start to do math on the algorithms of that. Now, how does this value you as a beekeeper pointing a camera at your hive and seeing bees flying around? Well, in the case of Eyes on Hive, they could tell when your hive starts up in the morning. They could tell when your hive gets active. They could tell different algorithms about if your queen goes down queenless, hives change their activity. Once you understand normal, you can look for not normal, and then if you can correlate that to the activity going inside the hive, then all you have to do is map that pattern, and chances are, in the future, you can watch your hives and figure out what's going on. So as you have heard and will hear, when you get a robbing situation, you're going to see a mass of bees flying around in a specific way in front of a hive. And I'm certain this thing could pick it out and tell you that your hives are being robbed. You could recognize positive trends. In the spring, when bees are ramping and more bees are flying, you're going to see more activity, which is going to show you, in correlation to your hive scale, how much your hives are growing and whether your yards are doing well or not, and maybe you need to put more honey supers on. Hey, Kevin moment. Look, I know. Duh. If you're in the spring honey flow, you don't need a camera to tell you. But there are times, I think, where this thing will provide you value, right? If I see flowers everywhere, I don't need a camera indicating that more and more bees are flying to tell me that the honey flow is on. I know. Look, I know. End of Kevin moment. Coming back to what I was saying a moment ago, if you can identify normal, then you can identify important changes in the colony's behavior and send the message along. And this goes back to the original analogy of the dentist. The dentist would like to know, of course, that you're brushing your teeth and doing it well and all those things. But they also want to know if something out of the normal is going on. Suppose you're, I can't think of a better analogy, so forgive me, but maybe you have a gum disease and your teeth are bleeding or something like that, and there's a sensor to indicate that. And then all of a sudden, the dentist knows, oh, something's going on here, we need to do it. Or maybe you're not doing it well, brushing your teeth well. Maybe you should be going up and down instead of side to side, or you're not getting into where the gums meet the teeth. I know, bad example, sorry. But, you know, the point of it is that what is not normal, you can report. Now imagine a future, a couple years from now, when the cost of this camera comes down to, say, the $20. And for $20, you could put one in front of every hive, along with a sound sensor, you know, all the things, you know, the broodminder costs are pretty low. The sensors are pretty reliable. You know, why would you not do this? And then what you could do, and I'm not saying you become an armchair beekeeper, but you would know if something's going on. And you would be able to get the flags of things are not going well. And if your hives are getting robbed out, you can stop and take action to close them off or do whatever. What's interesting is what type of sensors will emerge. Here you have something really unique in something like a radar gun that is telling you how many bees come and go. We already know we have sound, humidity, we have temperature, we have weight. What other sensors will emerge? Will there be odor sensors to tell you different activities are going on? They originally found this solution on an Indiegogo campaign, but the company seems to have moved on, and this was in May of 2016. They met their goal, exceeded it 150%. Congratulations to them. And now they're a full-fledged company. I found a lot of information about their solution at Keltronic. Actually, that's KeltronicsInc.com. KeltronicsInc.com. One of the things that you need to know before you consider this is you do need certain things to run this, meaning you have to have power and you have to have Wi-Fi connectivity at your hive. And then in addition to buying the device, they offer a subscription service for data analytics that includes the web app data visualization alerts and video storage. You could see the growth trends of your hive through this analytics. and better understand the hive's health and see the daily data and video highlights from your hive. I'm not sure if this means you'll have a webcam. I don't think it's used that way. And the other thing is, while I said count bees, there is more to this when you dig into the technology. They can analyze the flight pattern of the bees and extrapolate that to mean certain activities. So it's not just literally counting bees coming and going, because there are other solutions out there that you could put across your entrance that every time a bee goes past, it counts it, and they're probably a lot less expensive than this. This is more than that. This has other analytics and pattern recognition going back to Recognition, the app from Amazon that I was talking about earlier. They're doing more than just counting bees here. The Indiegogo campaign was $380, and it looks like production, they've still kept that cost. My guess is you get the camera and you get a year's worth of service. Not a guess, I know for a fact that in reading their website, you get the camera and 1 year of the analytics platform. I'm not clear on what it costs for the analytics platform after the first year, the subscription service, but I do see that they also offer program development and support services for $150. That solution allows you to have direct access to the folks who did this, I'm assuming. Premium support, maintenance, premium training packages, customization and algorithm tuning, project-based quotation. That's stuff I'm reading from their website. So, but you get it. Let me give some perspective, given that I'm in the IT industry. One, the camera looks like it's really high quality. This is not a webcam. It's a high-quality camera. It has to be in order to be able to render the fidelity they need to do what they're doing. The second thing is they did all the engineering and they're making a limited run of projects. And with that, you know, way that something ridiculously cheap like a security system that you buy at Walmart for $45 that comes with six cameras or whatever those things are you see at Costco, they sell bazillion of them, and they manufacture them in some place that is cheap. This is not that. This is research scientist quality stuff. And it might be, that's my guess, I don't know, I've never seen one of these in person, but I'm speculating based on what I'm seeing. But it's researcher type equipment that's made available to the homeowner. You can go buy one of these and get supported. And yeah, it was just an Indiegogo thing, so who knows how reliable. That was the one thing about buying Broodminders and stuff, is if Broodminder didn't work well, you didn't spend a ton of money. But the other system, if it didn't work well, you spent a lot of money on it, and you're hoping you're going to get your value. And for what it's worth, yeah, there's been some hiccups with the other system. We're not happy. We've had to make some corrections and we're not saying it's bad, we're just still trying to get comfortable with it. One of the reasons why low cost of entry is an important thing. I wouldn't say $380 to a lot of people is low cost of entry. This one's a little bit exotic, but look at what it does. It's pretty interesting tech. And eventually the cost will come down. So, all right, I've rambled enough on this. Keltronics, Inc., .com, KELTRONIXINC.com. We'll have a link in the show notes. Go to the website. Click on the videos. Pretty neat to see. They also show some charts and graphs, and they show you what you can and can't learn, some of what I've already told you. Pretty interesting technology. You should check it out. Topic number two, winter moisture boards. In the bonus episode I released last week on the topic of winterization, there was a little call out for the moisture prevention solution that uses homosote on top of a hive. In listening back, I realized that I did not say how to use it correctly, or more specifically, in the more conventional manner that people are accustomed to. And at the time of listening to it, I remember that I was trying to move the program along and went with what I was saying. But when I had a chance to get behind the microphone again, I should call it out and make a correction or add some more context to how to use these things. Also wanted to clean up the generality that I stated that Landy Simone uses these. I should be careful doing things like that because I know Landy does use these, but to what extent, I don't know. She sent a note this week saying she does use them, but on nukes that she overwinters. She has two-story mediums that are wintered in a condo-like arrangement. They are wrapped in a pair, and each of them have a moisture board and a small upper entrance, is what she sent. To be honest, I thought she used them more extensively, but that was probably bad listening on my part. I envision that listeners are going to walk up to Landy when they see her next time and go, you know, you use moisture, how do you use them? And she's going to wonder where the heck that came from. Before we talk about how to use a homosode board in a more conventional manner, let's talk about what one is, and we could start with what is in a homosode board, or what is homosode specifically. From homosode.com, the materials in the fiber board are 98% cellulose material. At its core, it's a combination of sawdust and ground paper. It is prepared with a wax emulsion, and it indicates, from what I could gather, that wax and water are blended and then the products are mixed. The blend with the water ensures a widespread dispersion of wax to all the particles, with the water evaporating off and leaving a product that has some moisture barrier properties. On the website, it states that the wax emulsion is separated by alum, which is an astringent compound. I went on a side journey to understand how alum was used in this process, and well, it has a number of uses, alum that is, but I guess in this case they use it to flocculate. What? Watch your mouth, Kevin. No, I didn't make that up. Flocculation is a process in which colloids, microscopically dispersed insoluble particles suspended through another substance, in our case wax and water, come out of a suspension in the form of flock or flake due to the clarifying agent. If I guess right, the alum is separating the wax from the water as it's probably churned, in my guess, like some sort of mixer, and then in turn it's binding and protecting the particulate matter, which is the sawdust and the ground paper. So whirl up wax in water, get it dispersed to small particles, and then use alum to make it come out of the water and settle across all of the products. And eventually it binds it all together, and it also coats it and provides a waterproof functionality for it. So really, another way that this alum is being used is it helps the material settle and form a collective mass. While I was reading about this, I came across an interesting note that there's an opposite process called deflocculating. It's used when you don't want things to settle. For example, a wastewater treatment plant. Yeah, sorry, this is a gross example, but maybe you don't want the solids to cake on the bottom of the treatment plant, so they deflocculate the slurry so it stays in a more dispersed form and they can move it along. So really, the simplest way to sum this up is the alum. Alum? I think that's how you say it. A-L-U-M. I don't think it's alum, like aluminium. Separates the wax from the emulsion used to distribute it and allows it to deposit on the cellulose fibers during the manufacturing process. So in addition to what was mentioned so far, they introduced some aluminum dihydrate into the manufacturing process as a fire retardant for this material. So remember, they're building some sort of home material, something that's going to be used in flooring or so on. And in some of their product lines, it appears that they may also add a starch component for increased board strength. But I don't think that's in play for the generic stuff that we're speaking of here. Hold on. The wax binds it together and prevents moisture absorption. I thought the premise of this was to use it for absorbing moisture. Isn't this backwards? Yes and no. In home construction, this product would always be encapsulated in some manner. Interior use or moisture barriers where it was pressed into service for external applications. You can use this stuff apparently for siding and roofing. In our case, we're going to allow time to overcome the product's ability to resist moisture and let it decompose to the point where the waxes are not a factor anymore and the actual products underneath, if you've ever seen newspaper get wet or sawdust get wet, it absorbs moisture and we're going to use that to our advantage. Okay, now you know what homosote board is and what the material is, which appeared to be of real interest at the meeting we host because people couldn't envision the actual product. Now I'm going to tell you how to use it in the two ways that I know how it has been used. The first one is the homosote board is cut in the same dimension as an inner cover. And like I said in the post, you put it right above the top brood box under the inner cover, and then the outer cover goes over it. It has a hole cut in it to match the inner cover so that moisture passes through. As I said in my talk, the premise of this approach is that the moisture board is sitting literally right over the brood and it will absorb it. But it has a hole so that the air could pass through that and the inner cover, which is sitting above it, and allow air to escape and keep ventilation of the hive. A conventional way to do this, and I can expound on this, is that you put the homosote board over top of the top brood box, the inner cover, and then a lot of people take a foam board, the same dimension as an inner cover, and put that over top. And it has a groove from the center over top of the hole in the inner cover out to the edge so that air can pass through. And the way this works in the sandwich that goes on top of the hive is the homosote board sits over top of the top brood box, absorbs the moisture. It has a hole. It allows the air to pass through. Sometimes, by the way, people skip the inner cover, and a lot of people will put the inner cover above the insulation just so it's there with the hive. But, you know, look, 85 ways to do something. Let me just stay on task here. Moisture gets absorbed by the homosote board, which is sitting right on top of the hive. Then you have the inner cover with a hole in it. And then you have a foam insulation board over top of it with a groove that allows the air to pass through. Then you put the roof on it. The reason for this is that the roof hangs down over top of all of those things, and it makes just enough cover to cover the edges of the homosote board. But the air hitting the front and side and back of the hive can get to that edge because the roof is not down over as much and let it wick off. But it provides cover for the edge of the material so that rain doesn't hit it and water works the other way, absorbs in. Now, I've heard beekeepers talk about, well, you use this homosote board to wick moisture out. How do you know it's not absorbing moisture from the ambient air? I don't want to get into the engineering. I don't know the answer to that, honestly. Now, contrast this with the commercial version and the other approach. Here, you take the inner cover and you put it over top of the brood box just in a conventional way. Then you take the homosote board, which has the groove cut in it from the manufacturer, and you put that over top. Now, air and moisture pass through the hole. Moisture gets absorbed by the homosote board on top of it, and air is able to escape out that channel, and voila, you have ventilation, and you put a roof over it. And when you put the roof over, it covers all the edges of the homosote, so it too protects it. But maybe it's not as good as wicking. Again, I'm not an engineer for this stuff. So those are the two ways to do it. The one thing that you could say about the first approach that's a downside, when you put that home soap board over top of the top brood box, the bees could propolize it. And when the material gets wet, it gets soft and it tends to break apart. If you go in the springtime, put your hive tool in between that and the hive box is going to win and the stuff is going to crumble and then you're going to lose your board. And it could create a mess. That's why the second design came where you put it over top of the inner cover and still get the moisture evaporating properties that you're looking for. Now, Kevin moment. I remember going to the beekeeping beginners class and Bob Hughes was there. And he would talk about all this stuff that was for sale in a catalog. And in a smidge of a curmudgeon kind of way, you don't need this, you don't need that. I actually would disagree with him on a couple things. For example, a hive hanger tool, I think that should be in everybody's kit. But the point of this thing is for sale. In fact, I'll put a link to the home soap board at Kelly website. Should you buy it? I don't know. And is this method with the groove cut in over top better than the one on the bottom? I don't know. What I will speculate is that chances are some beekeeper designed this, thought it was a good idea, put it out on the internet, and all of a sudden beekeeping supply houses start getting a phone call asking if you had the home soap board, and it's simple enough to manufacture, so voila, that's the one that ends up in the catalog. End of Kevin moment. Home soap moisture board, should you have one on your hive this winter? Hard to say, but now at least you know what one is and a couple of ways to use one. If you Google, or Bing, beekeeping home soap moisture board, you'll find a lot of resources as to what one looks like and how to use it. I would also add that one of the links I found when I did that was lancasterbeekeepers.org. It's a website that had plans for how to get 14 of these out of a single 4x8 sheet of home soap. You could buy one from Kelly for $7, no muss, no fuss, drop it in the cart, or you can have a day of it where you gather some friends, cut these things up, make a bunch of boards, and you could all have home soap boards for your apiary. Either way, works for me. Topic number 3, every hive counts. For this topic, I wanted to come back to center on my broodminder situation. Yeah, everything's okay. It's really me being lackadaisical and getting my sensors in the right order. So much so that I could actually talk about them here on the podcast. And I'm happy to say that I have achieved that milestone. What I mean by that is each sensor has a unique ID. And when you put a sensor in a hive and then you connect it to the application, you can read this stuff right away. No problem. But when you have more than one, and you don't realize which sensor is in what hive, then sometimes the data doesn't make sense. And me, being the dummy that I am, when you buy the sensor, it comes with a little tag. And the little tag has the unique code on it. And when you put a sensor in a hive, you put it in the hive, and the plastic enclosure has a tab that sticks out, and you can take that little label that they give you and put it on there so you don't have to open the hive to understand what the sensor is. I wasn't smart enough to keep the label. Duh. So I never knew which sensor was in what hive, and once I had more than one of them, I wasn't sure which hive I was reading. And every time I opened the hive and looked at the sensor, I never had anything to write it down, and I'd be trying to remember the code in my brain for by the time I got back in the house, but well, a brain is a simple thing to waste. In my case, I just could not keep it straight. So I went out recently with a mission, a pad of paper and a pencil, and opened the hive and wrote everything down. And now I know which sensor is in what hive, connected to which scale, and everything is good to go. It's amazing how stupid little things keep you from being organized. So the first tip is, if you buy a broodminder, don't do what I did. Follow the instructions, put the little label on, and then make a note when you set up your app of which hive is what. I also didn't take advantage of the feature of taking a photograph of the hive and associating that with the sensor, which was brilliant on their part. But, you know, again, disorganized as I am, sometimes I'm really scattered. So now I have the Citizen Science Package Scale with the two sensors that came with it on the hive, and I have a picture of it, and everything's good. So I'm good to go. There was another part of this is that I had the hive sensors in certain hives, and I've since consolidated them to different hives that I wanted to manage. I can now open my app, sync my data, send it to the cloud, and log into my cloud account from wherever I am and review the data on my phone in the app if I want to. And I also use the website interface, the dashboard you get with your account, to toggle the share my data information with the Be Informed partnership, so that officially makes me a citizen scientist. If, like me, you own sensors, you can see and manage the data at mybroodminder.com. The site used to be beekeeping.io, which is still in service. But in a recent announcement, Broodminder has shared that they renamed the URL to make it easier to remember, and it also helps them to explain it to others as they are interacting and selling devices. In addition to the sensors, and as I shared when I interviewed the proprietor, Rich Morris, they now have Broodminder Wi-Fi and Broodminder Cell, which I think is the same device. I'm not clear on that. The thing that you need to know is they're solar powered and hands-free. The device negates having to walk out to your hives and sync and update the data. That's not a huge problem. It's stupid simple to do that. But sometimes you have yards that are remote. You don't get out there and you don't get to sync the data. And having one of these things just makes it really, really easy. No muss, no fuss way to get your data to the cloud. And you could simply open the My Broodminder website and you'll always have your latest data available to you. Here's a really cool thing. You can see my hives online if you know where to look. And I'm about to tell you where to look. In addition to the website management consoles for the owners / subscribers, there's becounted.org. On this website, you could see, as of last count when I looked, 478 hives and the data that they are posting. If you zoom into New Jersey and click on the little bee pin for Stockton, New Jersey, you'll see the hives in my yard and the data that goes along with them. When you click on the little bee pin, a little panel pops up and hives with sensors are represented with a clickable hive ID. What's cool about this, as a person with sensors, I can share the URL to that hive ID with anyone I want, and they can follow what's happening in my region. In fact, if you go to bkcorner.org, you'll see a new feature there that has the clickable links to my hives. Clubs, individuals alike can bookmark these, and you can see what's going on with their hives, or at bcounted.org, you could look around to what's going on with hives in your region. When you click on that link to a hive in an apiary, you can see the data from the last sync. And in my case, I have linked my data with a local weather station, Weather Underground, that one of my neighbors has. I could see that his weather station is reporting the local weather and what's going on with my hives in my apiary. To be more specific, pick one of my hives and look at the temperature bands. There are four values reported. The temperature outside of the hive, as reported by the hive scale. The temperature of the middle sensor. the temperature of the upper sensor above the brew chambers, and the temperature with the label called outside is the one that presumably is from the Weather Underground weather station, which is about a quarter of a mile as the crow flies from my house. As you poke around beecounted.org, you can look at hive data from hives to your south, the north, that belong to others. You can glean, are hives shutting down? Is there a honey flow going on to my south in Delaware that's coming my way? All of these things are now possible with the publicly shared data. This might sound corny, but the power of every hive counts really is lighting up with beecounted.org. There's one other feature that comes from being a subscriber. In there, you have the option of sharing your data with someone else. And in this case, Bob Kloss and I have reciprocated sharing our data with each other. The byproduct of this is I could look at Bob's hives at any time, and he could look at mine. It's almost like having more sensors at your disposal. So that's really kind of cool. It expands the data set that you have at your access. Now, of course, I can't manipulate Bob's hives. I can't do things with his account. I could just see his data, so no harm, no foul. And the other thing is, it doesn't have to be somebody local. It could be somebody far away. Let's say you have a relative who lives somewhere else and you want to see how their hives are doing. You can peek in if they share the data with you. So there's one other thing to share is I have a broodminder cell in the apiary. And I have it working, but I'm not sure if I have it configured right. I simply need to set aside 5 minutes out of my busy schedule to go back and review the manual and see if I missed something. And I know the broodminder folks have been most helpful in the inquiries I've sent. And this is on me, not them. I have a few vacation days that I have to burn. If I don't get to it by the vacation days, I know that I'll soon have a window to dedicate time to getting that sorted out. In the interim, I could sync and post data, which allows me to keep things going. And I'm really enjoying having visibility into my hives. I'm most excited about the cell because there's times when I'm at work all week and I don't have time. If this thing is going to sync the data all the time, I could just peek in, and it's almost like having a baby monitor for my hives. I could just peek in and see how they're doing and watch them. And, you know, there's a few times when I need a distraction at work, and I need a distraction wherever I am. And it's not unlike the sensors that I have around the house that I could just open them up and look and see what's going on in the yard. And or they report back to me when something's going on and I set alarms for them. So pretty cool options available here. For me, I'm a bit late in getting organized, but I'm excited to go into winter with these sensors fully deployed, and I'm really looking forward to watching what happens when I don't have the opportunity to open my hives because of weather and seeing how my hives are going to overwinter. As often the case, one more thing to share, and this is a tip in general for anybody. I think you'll find this interesting. They have batteries, watch batteries, in these devices, in the sensors. The batteries are ECR2032 or CR2032. Usually they're Energizer batteries that people are familiar with. These things are not cheap if you buy them at ShopRite or Walmart, but on Amazon.com you could buy a 10-pack for $5.49. That was a tip sent by Broodminder, saying in the winter time, if you bought these, you might want to consider checking the battery and replacing them so that you don't have to open your hives if your sensors die. So the tip is, replace your batteries before winter and then get on that cycle, just like replacing your batteries for your smoke detectors at the time of setting the clock back, right? You know that old adage? My brain's not working very well today. But anyway, Energizer CR2032 3-volt lithium coin battery 10-pack in original packaging, $5.49 on Amazon. I've never seen them so cheap. If you type that title, which is why I read it out loud, you could find these yourself. Yeah, very cool. Broodminder.com is where you find all these devices. And becounted.org is where you can go take a peek and see the data that people are sharing. Three topics down, let's head to roundtable section of the podcast. We're going to start with apps that have a beekeeping tie, at least by name. First one I'll talk about is Honey. Honey automatically applies the best coupon at checkout. This has been advertised aggressively lately. I've been seeing it all over the place, wondered what it was. Joinhoney.com is the website, and it allows you to add something to your browser. And as you shop, you can save money by instant coupons or earning cash back. And the big thing that most people would probably like is get the best prices on Amazon. So that's the piece that I thought was interesting is, you know, a lot of times you could find different things for sale by different vendors in Amazon. And this Join Honey solution will look at Amazon and say it's cheaper available from a different vendor. So that's the first app. Joinhoney.com is the plugin location where you can get it for Chrome. Does not work with Microsoft Edge, as an aside. App number two, in a beekeeping theme for bees, is Bumble. The catch line is there's a fine line between dating and network, but one company thinks both can coexist in the same app. So as is with all the news, Weinstein lately, Whitney Wolf is the person who started this Bumble app, and it's an app where women make the first move after a difficult time of her own, and apparently she was one of the people who co-founded Tinder. So I'm a little past the age to use these applications where you might try to look and find a mate, but I do know some people who have met their match on Match.com and other solutions. It's not a surprise in this Generation X, Generation Z world that these things exist. But it feels interesting in this one is that the women are the one who have the control over what men they're going to choose explicitly. So that's interesting. If you haven't picked up, the theme is that they are using names common to beekeeper, but it has nothing to do with beekeeping. I have one more to share, and this one I do personally use and use it almost every day. This application is by the makers of Foursquare, and it is what happened to Foursquare after Foursquare became something else. So most people know Foursquare for checking in and gamification. And they split that section off to an app called Swarm. And I love this app. I hope it never goes away. It's going to be a sad day because, you know, sometimes you come to depend upon something and then unfortunately it goes away. In the case of Swarm, this is what happens. Wherever you go, you tap a little pin and it brings up a list of places it knows based on your location, and it lets you check in where you're at. Now, I've seen this in Facebook. I've seen it in other applications. I don't know why I don't want Facebook to let me check in, but I don't. What I like about this application is when you check in, you could take a photo of where you're at or attach a couple photos of things that are going on at the venue. And then later you can come back and say, you know, I was at this restaurant while I was in Seattle. It was a cool restaurant. And I'm going back out to Seattle next week with my friends. And maybe we should go to dinner at that place. Or I know of this really cool place and you're telling a story and you want to get some details. And you go back and you say, I was at this place in October last year when I was out so-and-so. And, you know, for me, I use this app with Sharon and with Brian and with Daniel, and they can see where I am when I check in, and I only share it with them. Sorry, everybody. But it has my history, and I really like the fact that I could tell where I've been, when I was there, and I take little pictures. It's kind of like a Facebook thing, but you know what bothers me about Facebook is it's not there anymore for me. I don't want to post my personal stuff for other people to see there, because I just feel like it's too intrusive. This is my personal little moments that I want to keep track of. So one of the things you might remember if you ever used Foursquare is you could be the mayor of a place. If you check in enough and you're the most prolific person there, they appoint you to the mayor. I'm currently the mayor of Bristol-Myers Squibb Nassau Park and a couple other places that I've been to. It's goofy. It's gamification. I don't really care. It's a little corny, actually. But fact of the matter is the app really does serve a purpose. It's called Swarm by Foursquare, and I would highly recommend that one. Roundtable number 2, Benny B. Honey. Listener Ben Stewart from Benny B. Honey in Deerfield, New Hampshire, wrote in to say hi and comment on the recent segment on honey being used in lieu of gel materials in transistor gates. He commented that as a chemist, he wishes we had come in just a little earlier, as he recently did some literature research in a seminar presentation on dielectric materials. Ben shared a link to his website, bennybhoney.com. It is on the board of the Pawtuckaway Beekeepers Association. The website is cool. There's some photos of the activities of beekeeping and some recaps of the adventures in their travels of getting started, and a simple listing of the products and services that they offer. I like that there are resources in helping people to get started and insights about the experience, including their experience with a flow hive. I will say, Ben, if you're listening, that you posted something that I've never seen before in one of those photos, and it's a plastic box that houses a package of bees. In my travels, I'm only familiar with wooden ones, and that one looked pretty cool. I wasn't sure what I was looking at first, but then it dawned on me when I recognized the can. I wonder if they're effective. I find it interesting that it has all kinds of engineered features for pegging them together and stacking them to assure airspace, is what I presume they're for. Seems pretty engineered coolness going on there with that thing. I would imagine that Ben, as a chemist, would be a pretty good judge of things, and in March he wrote into the BK Corner guestbook to say hi and post some insights about his experience on the flow hive. I think one statement in the middle of his share pretty much sums up what I think the overall thoughts are from my encounters with people who have them. I found the flow hive elegant, yet at the same time paradoxically problematic. That sentence was taken from the middle of his share with some context, but I'm going to borrow it because I think it's a poetic summary of what I've heard so far. Of course, I have one now, and next spring I'll get to experience the paradox for myself. Anyway, check out the effort, bennybhoney.com, and thanks, Ben, for taking the time to write in. And as an aside, I did see the links back to us when I was poking around and appreciate that too. You know, it's always kind of weird to me as I surf the web to find references to our work in this podcast. It's like, hey, that's me. Wow. You would think that after so many years, I would grasp that people are actually paying attention to this effort. Thanks, Ben, for writing in and staying connected. Good luck in your work as a beekeeper and with your local association. From me to you, you are an important resource to beekeepers. Keep up the good work. Roundtable number 3. I'm kind of bummed out because there was a YouTube channel from TRT Haber. I don't know what that was, but it was a person who made a log hive from a bandsaw, and it looked really similar to the log hive that I have out in the yard. This video showed someone taking a log section and cutting it on a bandsaw and creating that center hole, and then they take it out and they put it out in nature and make a hive out of it. I guess I won't go on and on about it since the video is not there anymore. It seems like YouTube shut the channel down that it was there, but very interesting to see how they did it. And one of the things I noted was that they took the saw from the outside and cut through the exterior, and then they ran it around a circle until they got the center out, and then they brought it back out to cut, and they maneuvered the log off and popped the center out. And I'm guessing that they took some sort of glue gun and glued through the seam that they cut in the outside, and from there they made a log hive out of it. The difference between that log hive and the one that I have is mine stands up. Theirs, they wanted to lay down. In other words, it was horizontal in shape. And they had them building comb from the domed roof of the hive, which I thought was unusual. Anyway, bummer. It's a bummer. Roundtable number 4, tincture. So I talked previously about trying to use propolis for trying to get rid of a wart on the pad of my left pointer finger. And it's not going really well. I'm guessing I'm not doing it right. I still think using propolis was better than the other method, which is salicylic acid. But in this case, what I was doing was melting the propolis and then putting it on... warming it up so that it softened a little bit, and then flattening it to a disc and putting it underneath a Band-Aid right on top of the wart that I have. So after a little while, I noticed that it doesn't seem to be doing anything. I see no difference at all, and I'm not very patient. Maybe I should be, but I haven't been. What I've come to learn is that the tincture part of it is probably important to the delivery of the medication of propolis to the actual surface. What is a tincture? It is an alcohol derivative of propolis, or maybe derivative is not the right word. You put propolis in alcohol and it breaks down, and then you put the liquid on your finger and the alcohol opens up and penetrates the skin and delivers the medicine. So a tincture is a medicine made by dissolving a drug in alcohol. That's the definition of it. And my guess is it uses something along the lines of maceration, which by definition is to soften or become softened by soaking in a liquid. I think I talked about this last time. There are three ways to prepare propolis. You could do it in ethanol, glycol, and olive oil. And in this case, I made a run to Central Liquors and bought a bottle of Everclear. I actually went to two health places trying to find out if I could buy alcohol product. One of them was a store in Flemington, and they don't sell that stuff. My guess is, like anything else, they're not going to sell you a pure grain alcohol because anybody could buy it and use it for bad and nefarious things. But you can get the closest cousin to that, which is Everclear, a grain alcohol, which should serve the purpose. And I don't know why I bought a huge bottle and it cost me $20 to do this, but for science, I'm going to make a tincture. What I did find at the natural market was the little jars that you could use to put it in with the dropper. So at least I have something to use. To be clear, what I was trying to find was ethanol, which is 96%. And I had to fall back to grain alcohol, which I don't know if that's a vodka or not, but it's 90%. And the difference is the ability to dissolve the propolis is my guess. But again, I'm not an expert in this. The recipe couldn't be any easier. You grind your propolis up or cut it up into smaller pieces, 1/2 to 1 millimeter, put it in alcohol, and after 3 days of maceration, the extraction should be complete. Now, I think they're meaning 95% ethanol, and I have Everclear, so it's probably going to take a little longer than that. The formula on the website that I'm reading, healthywithhoney.com, says that you could use 70% ethanol, the maceration of 20 grams of propolis, in 100 milliliters of ethanol, and that was complete in 30 days. So that's a combination of two recipes, but what I really needed to know was how much propolis should I put in the alcohol, and that at least gives me a tip in that way. On this website, there is a literal step-by-step method of how to make a tincture. Place your propolis in a freezer. Once it's frozen, mill it or break it into small pieces. Remove any coarse pieces or excess wax, things that are not propolis. Put it in a dark bottle and add the alcohol. 100 grams of propolis to 400 milliliters of 70% ethanol is the formula in this recipe. Store it in a dark container, shaking it occasionally, and should be about 2 weeks or so, you should be able to get a tincture out of it with 70% alcohol. After you've let it macerate for as long as you want to let it, you can filter it through a paper filter, like a coffee filter, into a different jar. I actually bought two jars. I bought one with a dropper and one to mix with, and then just start using it. While in the health store, there was an option by the person there, I don't know who he was, but he knew about this, to use propylene glycol. He suggested that if I didn't want to go to the liquor store, I could buy some of that. This website says, compared to ethanol, glycol can dissolve less propolis, only like 20 grams per 100 milliliters of glycol. Yet glycol tinctures are highly antioxidant and can be used in skin protection. In my travels today, some point, I'm going to take care of my tincture and put it together. And in a few weeks' time, I'll be trying that out. You know, while I was on that website, I found something interesting about propolis. The website points out a couple things that I knew. Propolis is used as natural medicine in dentistry, but it goes on to say in veterinary medicine and cosmetics as a food preservative, which we talked about, and other things. Air disinfectant, that's interesting. And apparently it has some purpose in wood varnishes. I guess if you think about it, propolis is a lot of sap-style qualities to it, so that would make sense. It does go on to say that in the past, propolis has been used more commonly as a wood preservative or varnish, and it's claimed that the famous violins of Stradivarius contain propolis. It's derived from tree saps and B enzymes, which are powerful combinations. And if you think about it, and this was an interesting thing that they pointed out, tree saps are more prevalent than we probably give credit to. Birch tree is used to make beverages, birch beer and things, but it also has an anti-parasitic, anti-inflammatory aspect to it. Pine tree sap, the resin is chewed by native peoples to alleviate joint pain. You could use spruce sap as a traditional cold remedy. Frankincense, I love that word. Of course, we know it's used as an aromatic and sometimes in healing potions, but it could also be used for skin ailments such as wounds, burns, and arthritis. And of course, one of our favorite saps is the maple tree. You use the sap to make maple syrup. This reference that I'm speaking of, I'll provide a link to the show notes, and below this part, it has what are the common propolis and not so common preparations. And things like propolis pills and semi-solid preparation and a paste and emulsions and concentrates and creams and ointments, oh my. Propolis butter, propolis cream for dentistry. And it has recipes for every one of these things there, which I think is really, really cool. So check it out. I'll have a link to HealingWithHoney.com forms of bee propolis ointments, pills, essence, spray, syrup, toothpaste, and webpage. And thanks to whoever created this. Appreciate that. Roundtable number 5. The boys are back in town. I went to check on my podcast on iTunes to see if the feed was working correctly. And I ended up milling around a bit to see if there was anything new in the beekeeping world. While I was there, I left a rating and review for the Beehive Jive podcast, which I love. And it led me to believe that my goading possibly worked for another beekeeping podcast that's now back on the air. I clicked on the feed for Hive Talk with Dave and John, and dang if I didn't see that they started recording again. So if you rewind the tape, I spent a few minutes catching up with John and David at EAS and browbeat them for about 10 minutes on why they dropped their recording effort. I spent a few minutes of getting them all frothed up about why it wasn't as difficult as they were making it, and we walked away from the conversation with them saying they were going to get back on the horse. So I kind of smirked and thought they were humoring me, but again, darned if they didn't actually start recording again. Here's what you do. Visit iTunes and search for Hive Talk with Dave and John. John is spelled J-O-N. When I listened to them, I immediately recognized their tongue-in-cheek delivery and how they constantly barb each other. They somewhat remind me of the two guys that do the Sonic commercials. But I won't make assertions as to which one is which. So truth be told, and all kidding aside, both are EAS master beekeepers and really know their craft. Clearly worth the listen, and I'll be checking in now that I know they're releasing new episodes again. Wait, maybe not the Sonic guys. Maybe the reincarnate of Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers, the old public radio show about fixing cars. Yeah, that's more accurate. You know, as I think about it, not everyone has iTunes, and I'm going to give a link to the TalkShoe website. TalkShoe is the website that they're using for recording of podcasts. TalkShoe.com and search for Hive Talk with Dave and John. Or visit our show notes for the link, because I'll have it there, as you know. Roundtable number 6, Mite Calculator. I received an email from longtime listener in Missouri, Lloyd Braun, about a website that he put out called mitecalculator.com. The effort is dedicated to providing a mite load calculator for beekeepers who use oxalic acid vaporizations, which I am now in the club. I did the last 2 weekends. The website sews together an algorithm that takes into account how many mites dropped after a treatment, the hours that you had since the drop, whether or not you have capped brood, and what the hive population is. With those different factors, you can calculate what your mite load is. And in this, he provides a very simple instruction. Step 1. Put a clean sticky board under your screen. Step 2, do an oxalic acid vaporization treatment. Of course, you should write down the time of day because you're going to track the hours. Step 3, if you can, 24 hours later, remove the sticky board. Step 4, count the mites. And step 5, fill out the calculator and see your estimated mite load. In the post-treatment mite drop category, you could choose from 1 to 1,000 mites that you've counted. Hours of mite drop, the range is 20 to 30 hours. The capped brood question is, was there any capped brood? And the answers are, no capped brood, 1 deep with capped brood, 2 deeps with capped brood. And the hive population, the answers are, winter, 10,000 bees, weak, 20,000 bees, transition, 30,000, strong, 40,000, boiling over, 50,000. So if I play pretend, let's say I counted 314 over 24 hours with 2 deeps, capped brood, in a transition hive that has 30,000 bees, what I learned from that is the phoretic mite load in my hive before it treated was 5.4. And my true mite load percentage for pre-treatment, this is about how many mites you had in your hive before you treated, including inside the cap cells, was 16.9. So this is cool, isn't it? Cool little tool. And then below the tool, there's some information about phoretic versus true mite load and the definitions, how you estimate your population, and some insights about knowing when to treat your hive, with a caveat at the bottom that it's still a good idea to do traditional mite tests, either sugar roll or alcohol wash. So you could check this out, mitecalculator.com. If you give the mite calculator a whirl, you can go to the menu and click Get Involved. And there's a form you could fill out to help improve the mite calculator and share your information. In addition to the mite calculator, there's a blog here, Around the Bee Yard blog. And if you click the link in the menu there, you'll see different entries that Lloyd has. And I loved the one for winterizing hives. I know I just covered it, and he sent me a note saying he showed and shot a video of winterizing his hives. One of the things that I thought was really cool is he put a visor on his hives. And I'll describe this. He took an L bracket and a piece of wood and affixed it to the hive, and it creates like a false roof over top of the entrance. The point of this is if you have a hive that's in snow and you can't get out there to clean it off, this thing should protect snow from accumulating if it falls straight down on the hive entrance. I thought that was really, really cool. Never seen one of those. That was a post from October 25th, just a couple days ago. And you could check that out around the Bee Yard blog. There's a few other things on the website, and they can all be accessed from mitecalculator.com. So thanks, Lloyd, for sharing that. Appreciate it. I think we've reached a place where I want to close the episode down. Let me give a couple odds and ends before I bid adieu. I have an extra Arlo camera that I purchased with a system, and I was thinking about putting up a gateway and putting that camera out in the apiary and sharing the ID and password where someone could log in. So I think I'll play with that today and see if I can get that up and running and put that out on the website. Could actually consider putting it up for security, but where's the fun in that? Sometimes Bob Kloss and I get together and do things, and that is after we haven't connected for weeks. And when we do connect, we exchange insights and stories, and sometimes we get together and do things. And such was the case this past week where we went to a meeting together. And then, as I mentioned, he was over at the house and we were chatting. And well, I have a couple of adventures that we were on that I recorded because, like I always yell at him to take pictures, I try to bring the recorder when we get to chatting. And I'm going to release an episode somewhere in the next week of a couple things that we talked about. Should be a lot of fun. So before I close out, I wanted to take a moment and say thanks to those who are making PayPal donations. I don't get a lot of them, but when I do, I really appreciate it. In fact, I've been thinking about Gasp going to an advertising model somewhere along the line because of the amount of money it's costing me to do hosting for this. Been paying for everything out of pocket, and it's become pretty expensive lately. I've been looking at the bills mounting, and somewhere along the line, I have to figure out if I can find a way to recoup some of this. I know one of the things I'm looking at right now is the purchase of a recording software that would make recording this podcast 1,000 times easier, but unfortunately it's like $400 as an example, and maybe Santa will bring it to me, but at some point we had to figure out some way to raise some funds. I'm really not a fan of schlepping Patreon campaigns. They really serve a good purpose, but anyway, I'll be mulling that over for 2018. But to those who do donate to PayPal, thank you very much. And if you want to help the effort, I know usually you plead, but it goes a long way. I'll simply say you can find a PayPal link on our homepage, bkcorner.org. Okay, time to go, everybody. Like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, and be well.